Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Jim Clifford's talk, From a Pastoral Wetland to an Industrial Wasteland and Back Again, an environmental history of the Lower Lee River Valley, the site of the 2012 London Olympics. The talk is the second of three lectures in the Mississauga Library System's History Mind series. Please check back again on ActiveHistory.ca in the near future for more recordings.
Painting was actually commissioned by the railroad company before the railroad was built, I think probably to show that it wasn't going to transform the landscape that much. It was still going to be a beautiful place to fish, and this nice railroad would just go amongst the windmills in the background. About 15 years later, they built a massive deep water dock in the south marshlands of the borough. This land was only really used for grazing cattle beforehand to fatten them up before bringing them to the London market. It was an ideal place to build a dock because it was already below the water level of the Thames, so you didn't have to excavate too much. You just had to dig down a little bit, build walls, and dig a hole into the river wall and let the water in. So these two developments also brought on some really significant environmental and social problems. Most importantly was having people move down onto the wetlands near where the docks were being built in a real haphazard and unplanned way. There's no real local government, there's just the parish council. So for the first few years, it was a free-for-all. And the houses were just built along the marsh drainage ditches, and these were used as sewers, so open sewers. And in 1855, the more affluent people in the community signed a petition asking to be formally made into a local board of health so they could control some of these problems. And the national government sent Alfred Dickens to investigate. And he's particularly interesting because he happens to be the brother of Charles Dickens. And we'll discuss him quickly in a minute. Alfred Dickens' report focused on the just foul condition of the communities living on the wetlands, and particularly on the close proximity between the homes and these former drainage ditches, which are not built to be sewers. They were just built to bring the water level down. But as you can see in this picture, a privy or a toilet was situated right beside the ditches, and they were not fast flowing, so through much of the year, the human waste would just accumulate in the marshlands. So 2 years after the reports and the local board of health had been created, I think Alfred didn't think his recommendations were being followed closely enough, so he brings his brother into West Ham to show him around. And by this point, Charles Dickens is a very famous author and has his own newspaper. And he writes quite a lengthy editorial describing his two visits over a period of about 6 months to West Ham. And I've just taken out one of my favorite quotes. "We come to a row of houses built with their backs to a stagnant ditch. We turn aside to see the ditch and find that it is a cesspool, so charged with corruption that not a trace of vegetable matter grows on its surface, bubbling and seething with the constant rise of the foul products of decomposition that the pool pours up into the air. The filth of each house passes through a short pipe straight into this ditch and stays there. Upon its surface, to our great wonder, a few consummative-looking ducks are swimming, very dirty, very much like the human dwellers in the foul alleys, as to their depressed and haggard I can never say that word. I'll let you read it. And to be weighed by ounces, not pounds. Some of them may be ducklings, but they look like the most ancient ravens." What I think is really important here is the connection he makes with the human population and the suggestion that there's a real strong connection between these awful environmental conditions and the public health of the people living amongst this. So environmental problems are also human problems in this space from the very beginning of the industrialization. So in the century or half century that follows, as you saw in the population graph, industrialization happens very rapidly. There's a number of explanations for this. First of all, and this is the argument made by a lot of contemporaries at the time, West Ham's location outside of London meant that it didn't have to abide by the growing list of public health regulations within London. And we see this happening in cities across North America as well, where the worst of the noxious industries are pushed outside of the city limits. where the stronger central city governments have no control, and where the industrialists often have a lot of power on whatever form of local government exists, and this is the case in West Ham, where these industrialists had a great deal of influence in the local government. The second argument is that these rivers provide an easy way to move coal around. And in the 19th century, the most important factor in industry is cheap energy. There's no electricity wires yet, and it's quite expensive to move coal by train, even more expensive to move it by horse and cart. So you need your industry to be right on the water, and this meant you didn't even have to build the canals, because you had this ready-made half dozen streams to build your factories beside. And the final point is simply that West Ham is the next place in the development. In the decades before this, the Isle of Dogs and Poplar had filled with development. So London was moving eastward, and this was the next location for development. So these three factors contribute to it. The first map shows a concentration. If you see the red squares, these are all chemical factories. And then this is a huge rail works, the biggest in England, that's developing. And this is one of the last major shipbuilding firms in London. So those are the major sites of industry. But for the sake of this topic, it's particularly all these chemical industries on smaller locations along the streams. And 2 decades later, we see an expansion of chemical industry here. The rail yard is much bigger. Chemical industry up in this northern reach, which is this area right here, is where the Olympics are now being built. So back to my second reason. I think this is probably the most important factor in explaining why West Ham becomes such a major center of industry. And in this late 19th century, it is right at the heart of London's industry. Much of the industry in the center of London had begun to decline. It was too expensive to move coal. And the property value was getting too high to keep having industry right in the center of London. So you can see in this picture the coal barges that moved coal from the Royal Docks up the river. And perhaps the most important industry has come back. It's this little Corrie and Sons right in the middle of the dock here. Right at the beginning, in 1855, they installed hydraulic cranes that would move coal from coal ships coming down from Newcastle or Cardiff into those barges in the next picture. So, not surprisingly, this all led to some unpleasantness in the rivers of West Ham. By the end of the 19th century, so this picture's from about 1900, the conditions of the rivers were getting so full of garbage and pollution that it was increasingly difficult to move the barges up and down the rivers. You can see in this picture that there's not much vegetation. Now, it could have been taken in wintertime, but it still shows quite a blighted landscape by 1900. These are chemical factories down this side of the river. This is a very large gas works down at the bottom. And these are actually vegetable gardens, allotment gardens. So back to my central argument of the just really close proximity between social problems, public health, and the environmental problems. People were growing food right beside these chemical factories. So environmental problems were social problems. There's just no way to disconnect these issues. The only people who generally lived in the wetland sections, and I don't know how well you can see it, the wetland sections above this half of the city, this is higher ground up here, And this is showing infant mortality rates in 1903. And this is showing mortality rates in 1899. And you can quite clearly see that the people living in the higher ground up in the northeast of the borough, which also is a more middle-class neighborhood, have very low levels of infant mortality and death rates. Whereas the locations down in the marshes have, in some cases, staggeringly high infant mortality rates. High Street in 1901 has over one in five children were dying. So really remarkably high mortality rates in that year, mostly from diarrhea, which is caused by flies moving around human waste. And so in a very dirty environment, there's more flies, and if the sewer system's not working very well, that can just cause a really incredibly high rates for children under 12 months old. One of the biggest environmental problems in West Ham throughout this period is flooding. So this shows the three biggest floods. This one, which is mostly worn away, is from 1897, 1904, and 1928. So there's three causes of flooding in West Ham. The first is just a very heavy rainstorm. Most of this area that's shaded is below the high water level of the rivers, so the only way to get the water out is to pump. So they had coal-powered steam engines pumping water out. If it rains harder than your pumps can move that water out, you'll get regular flooding. They have flooding every year. They still have flooding every year on a minor level. If it's a particularly bad rainstorm, then water will come shooting down the Lee Valley from up north. And they turn most of that river into a canal, so it would come down even faster. Most of the wetlands have been developed with housing or farming, so all the sort of natural systems to absorb water are being developed by humans in the 19th century, so it speeds the rate that water comes down the river. The problem is they didn't do any of that engineering in the lower Lee. So here, you've got about six bridges along this road, which some of them date back hundreds of years, so they're very old stone bridges, which don't let a whole lot of water through them. And then you also have those mills I was talking about, and mills are designed to trap water. And there was no real system to allow that water to flow down during a really big flood. And those mills were expanding during the early 19th century, making the problem of flooding even worse. And then there's the third cause of flooding, which is a gale in the English Channel will sometimes send storm surges up the Thames, which would then burst over the river walls. And each of these three cases are example of these storm surges. And anybody familiar with London today, or maybe you've seen pictures of it on the internet, there is a Thames barrier now, this multi-billion dollar apparatus that closes and stops these storm surges from flying up the Thames anymore. Unfortunately, it might be a few feet too low. If the ocean levels continue to rise, they might have to rebuild this multi-billion dollar storm defense in the next few decades. Okay, so these floods are a social, economic, and environmental problem. When the water goes flowing into over the river walls, it often first hit the factories. You can see the factories are right along the rivers. It would stop some of the factories from working, and in some cases it caused the boilers to explode at the shipbuilding yard here. I think that was the 1904 flood. So that's a pretty big economic problem. It would take all the chemical stores that you have sitting in your yard and liquefy them and spread them. So that's an economic problem. It's obviously a bit of an environmental problem as well. So keep that in mind as we come forward to talking about the remediation work they're doing at the Olympics right now. And then we can see by the end of the 19th century, this large community of canning town. So these are probably the better part of 100,000 people that are living down on the what I call partially reclaimed wetlands. And so this water filled with sewage and chemicals and industrial waste then flowed into the basements and first floors of these communities. And there's still a few pictures around of the beer barrels floating away from the pubs, which probably was a particular tragedy, because you'd need beer to live in this place. So hand in hand with this major environmental problem of flooding, West Ham also had periodic, every 5 to 10 years, economic crises, particularly by the beginning of the 20th century. This rapid industrial boom and population growth both flattened out in the first decade of the 20th century. There have been economic downturns before, but this one was particularly bad. And it brought West Ham to the attention of the rest of the nation for the first time. So before this, West Ham was sort of a place on the edge of London that somebody might have to travel to on business every once in a while or return from as quickly as they could. And beyond that, it was out of mind for regular Londoners, which until it became an Olympic site, I think it had been. And again, the only thing that anybody seems to know about West Ham, if they're not from the east of London, is the football team and its notorious rowdy fans during the 1970s and 80s. So they became sort of the national headline story. Some of the major papers, like the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph, ran subscriptions to big, huge relief funds, because the Daily News, it became obvious to the population of London that the sort of laissez-faire economics were not working in West Ham. And too many people were either very underemployed or unemployed. A major jute factory closed down. The ironworks, the Thames Ironworks, the shipbuilding yard, lost all of its naval contracts. So it does hold on for another 7 years after this economic crisis, but on a vastly reduced scale. They never come close to the 3,000 plus people who were working there when they were building warships in the 1890s. So West Ham, actually, the clamor around West Ham forces the National Conservative Government into action in 1905. And they pass something called the Unemployed Workmen's Act. This is the first time that the national government gets really involved in what we now call shovel-ready projects, public works projects to put the unemployed to work. In the 19th century, this is experimented with a few times during the Irish famine in the 1880s, but it had mostly been a failure, and the sort of prevailing laissez-faire liberal ideology made it very difficult for politicians to get behind it. By the early 20th century, there's been a bit of a social democratic turn, at least for a lot of progressives in London, and there's a growing willingness of having the state intervene in the economy to try and fix the unemployment problems, something we're very familiar with today. But they're still terrified of doing anything that would wreck the employment market, so you couldn't do anything too useful, because that's something that the market should be doing. So you had to find public works in the town that weren't necessary. You couldn't just go build roads like we do today, because that would be interfering with the market. So they do a few things in West Ham. They build a labor colony in the countryside and send a few hundred men off to learn how to be farmers again. Because one of the hopes is maybe you can repopulate the countryside. This is something that a wide range of thinkers, from socialists to progressives and liberals and conservatives, are dreaming of these labor colonies as the big answer to urban social problems. But this could only deal with a few hundred people at a time. So they also start to work on the drainage just north of the borough in Wanstead Flats. The first year they build a lot of drainage ditches, and in the second year, 1906 to 1907, they build this huge man-made lake. So the picture we're looking at right now is of, and it's hugely successful actually, because it's very simple work. All you need is shovels. There's very little cost, so almost all the money going into this project went directly into the pockets of unemployed men. And it turned out to be very cost effective. The work was done well, and it wasn't any more expensive than getting a firm to do it for you. So this gives people in West Ham, the local political elite, a lot of hope that maybe they can continue to find money to do big projects like this. And this is where we connect flooding back with unemployment. So the borough engineer comes up with a plan in early 1908 to hopefully take some of this money for unemployed and deal with this decade-long problem of flooding in the back rivers. And the hope is that you can transform these back rivers into functional canals. This would be a boon for the economy. It would open up new land for industrial development. They had a few canals, as we saw earlier on. So if you can turn that mess of a back river into a nice orderly stream like this, it would address your environmental problem of flooding, and it might be good for the economy, and it would help the social problem of unemployment, because this would be a much bigger project than the lake construction, and it really could have put workers from West Ham and many of the surrounding boroughs to work for a few years in the late years, the first decade of the 20th century. The project fails, so they don't do it this first time. First of all, because the minister in charge is really reticent to see this program expand at all, and then believes that if we keep going down this road, then there's going to be demands for sort of guaranteed full employment. And even though he spent the first 10 years of his political life as a socialist, he was now a firm convert to the laissez-faire liberal ideology and was unwilling to allow this. So, believe it or not, he was arguing with Winston Churchill, who spent the rest of his life being an anti-socialist, to not fund these programs any further. Churchill thought, you know, this isn't actually that bad of an idea. It created a bit more social harmony. So it doesn't happen because of that. It's also just too complicated a project this early on. There's big concerns about liability, because getting just men to dig out these canals would mean you'd have to block them off on either end for months at a time. And if a flood did come down during those months, it would be a far bigger problem, because there'd be nowhere for the water to go. And they couldn't quite figure out who would be liable in that situation. So the town lawyers and the Lee Conservancy Board lawyers got involved, and that stopped the project dead in its tracks. But there were consequences for not dealing with flooding during this opportunity in 1908-1909. If you remember the picture of the three floods, 1928 is the next one, and it's significantly worse than any of the floods that had come before, and it floods much of the town. Really quite devastating. And then a year later, the global economy collapses. So the politicians in West Ham immediately say, we've got an idea. We've been wanting to do this for 25 years, and they go straight to Parliament and have a bill passed to dramatically transform the Lower Lee River in 1930. It takes 5 years. They go way beyond their plans from the 1908. They widen the high street. They fill in two of the rivers, move many of the rivers a few feet in various directions. And there's a real hope that this is going to be a solution to the pretty steady economic decline this region had been experiencing for the first decades of the 20th century. So again, we see this grand plan to solve both the social and environmental problems of West Ham through a big public works project. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work. It does make these rivers better. They have these lovely concrete walls now. It decreases the threat of flooding to a certain degree, although in the next huge storm surge of 1953, West Ham does get flooded again, so it's not a perfect solution to flooding. And sort of speed through, that's the river that disappears that my arrow just pointed at. West Ham becomes a sort of classic inner suburb in the 20th century. So this map is not the best map, but it gives you some indication of the spread of London during the 20th century. This is a map of today, and West Ham is now really in the center of London, or in the edge of the center of London. But there's a freeway called the M25 that goes the whole way around. It's sort of the boundary, and I've done it once. It's about a 25-kilometer walk from West Ham up to the M25, and you're going through suburbs almost that entire time. And they've now spilled far beyond that as well. There's a green belt, but there's lots of areas in Surrey that are suburbanized as well. So during this time period, West Ham, its population declines quite dramatically. In 1965, it's incorporated into Greater London, and it's combined with East Ham and North Woolwich into a new borough called New Ham, really original. The last census in 2001 put the population of New Ham at just over 250,000 people. So that's three boroughs combined, or I guess 2.25 boroughs combined. The population in West Ham is about half what it was 100 years earlier. Partially this is just because people stopped living three families to a house in England. The housing supply crisis eventually gets sorted out throughout the 20th century, and things like improved commuter trains, the tube, allow people to, and eventually the automobile, but that's less significant than it is in Toronto, allow people to live further and further away from home, work, so you don't have to live walking distance from your factory anymore. But it's also because the industry goes through a rather protracted decline. Lots of mergers and acquisitions in the post-war period. The Second World War is quite devastating to West Ham. It's sort of the first place you get to when you're flying from Berlin. So a lot of German pilots decided they'd let off the bombs and turn around and go home before they got into the really ugly anti-aircraft fire. So West Ham is really devastated in the Second World War, and it never really recovers from that. It's been on decline already. There's still two or three big factories, a big sugar factory on the waterfront, but very little factories in the Lower Lee Valley. So this is a picture I took in 2007. You can see these remade back rivers with their concrete walls. It's sort of become overgrown. You could barely walk through this region. And so planners started to talk about it as the least developed section of London. I always found it to be kind of odd term for a place that has any century of rapid development. I managed to write a dissertation about it, but because it had not been sort of actively developed for about 60 years. It becomes, in planning parlance, the least developed section of London. A lot of the factories had sort of given away to just storage sites, very light industry scaffolding. There's all kinds of places with big stacks of scaffolding. So I guess it just became a cheap place to keep equipment, factories full of tires. Every time I turn a corner, I'd be a little bit more surprised by what I found. So it should not come as any big surprise that as they planned the Olympics, or planned a bid for the Olympics, this seemed like an obvious place. Also, I understand that this issue is happening in Mississauga right now. It's really, really expensive to clean up industrial wastelands like this. So you don't want to do it yourself because you could never sell enough condos to pay the billions of dollars needed to remediate this kind of an industrial space. So you need to figure out a way to convince the British taxpayers to spend £9 billion. So you sell them the Olympics. And being that this was the 2000s, we also were very excited about the environment for at least 3 or 4 years. So you had to pretend that the environment was a central goal. So these are just a few quotes from the website that's been taken down. It's the website from about 2006, talking about the legacy. So the Olympic Park will lie at the heart of the Lower Lee Valley, just 4 miles from Tower Bridge, currently one of the capital's most underdeveloped areas. The Lee Valley is an area of outstanding potential, which will be transformed. The Games legacy will transform this area into one of the largest urban parks created in London for more than 150 years. The natural river system of the valley will be restored. Canals would be dredged and waterways widened. Bird watchers and ecologists will be able to enjoy 3 hectares of new wetland habitat. The rehabilitation of the Lower Lee Valley lies at the heart of the Olympic legacy to East London, restoring an ecosystem and revitalizing an entire community. So here we are again, a recognition that the social problems and the environmental problems are connected. And this huge government project is going to solve this. And the social problems, you know, this was one of the worst boroughs in London. It continued to be a place where people came when they first arrived in London. So it was one of the most ethnically diverse regions of London, one of the most impoverished regions of London, and one of the most crime-riddled regions of London. Although those things are not necessarily connected, because I think there's a lot of the football fans that contributed to the crime problems. Those were not necessarily the ethnic diverse segment of the population. So here's the grand vision for the 2012 Olympics. We have the before picture from Google Earth that shows the remnants of this industrial landscape. And we have the park. It's about 3/4 of the way there now that the stadium's been built. It sure doesn't look this green yet, but I'm sure we'll be planting a lot of grass this summer to achieve that. So what about this promise of the Green Olympics? I think it will be, to some extent, cleaning up this environmental mess. Maybe not worth the price tag, but surely a valuable thing to do for the community. But there were some problems along the way, particularly when they told these allotment gardeners that they had to get out. So this Green Olympics, we're going to destroy a 100-year-old allotment garden, one which had been given to gardeners in perpetuity. Apparently, as long as you have the Prime Minister behind you, you can erase contracts such as that. You can see just how lush these gardens were. In some cases, it was multi-generational farmers who had been farmed by the same family for 70 years. Deep part of the East London community, a really important part of working class culture in East London. And in my mind, a vernacular landscape that's just as important to English culture as the rose gardens homes of aristocrats that the heritage community liked to protect. It probably won't surprise you when I say that the gardeners didn't win this fight. Most importantly, it was right in the way of a bridge between the train station and the main stadium, and for traffic flow reasons, you just couldn't divert that. Second of all, one of the garbage dumps in this area had a lot of radium in it. They built radium watch dials in the early 20th century in this region, and radium is radioactive. They just dumped it in the ground 80 or so years ago. Taking it back out again was going to mean the dust in the area was going to be very toxic and dangerous. The river and most of this land is some of the dirtiest in England, so again, just the dust created by this project, you really couldn't have farmers or gardeners wandering in and out of this site during the 5 years where they were processing and getting rid of this toxic legacy. When everything was sort of under a layer of grass, you know, it was safe enough, but during the project, I have to agree, it was probably the right decision, but a sad one nonetheless. So the last question is, they are going to clean up the environment. It's going to be a lot better. It already is. We spent a lot of money, but the rivers will be cleaner. Much of this toxic legacy of these chemical factories will be gone. There'll be lush green grass growing and new trees. There's also going to be a whole lot of new condos. They've already started building them. So a question that a lot of critics have been asking is, what happens to the people of West Ham? Are they going to be the ones who benefit from this new environment? And I sort of wonder, everything I know about this place has been this close correlation between the environment and the social class of people who lived there for 150 years. I have a hard time imagining that now that the environment is going to be cleaned, that this correlation is not going to continue. And the impoverished people, the socially disadvantaged people of West Ham, will be pushed aside once again, out to some less desirable, probably dirtier section of London. And the vast majority of the people who will enjoy this new landscape will be living in condos like on the waterfront in Toronto. They'll be professional, single, 32-year-olds enjoying life. And a story from March 9th suggests this process is already beginning. A lot of the canals were lined with these old converted barges. People lived in them, very low mooring fees. Nobody really cared for decades because nobody went there anyways. Well, they just talked about going from £600 a year to £7,000 a year. So that seems like a pretty deliberate method to move some socially undesirable people out of these canals and open them up so that more socially desirable people can use the space. So this is yet to be seen. I don't want to be overly pessimistic because I think particularly the parklands they're going to create is going to create this great recreational space. I'm a jogger. I love running through Toronto's ravines. I think this will be a spectacular place for London's joggers and cyclists to enjoy for generations to come. But there's going to be consequences, and I imagine the social and environmental connections will remain. 10 years from now, it's going to be a cleaner and less poor neighborhood. Thank you very much.
You've just been listening to a recording of From a Pastoral Wetland to an Industrial Wasteland and Back Again, Environmental History of the Lower Lee River Valley, the site of the 2012 London Olympics. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for more recordings.